Anything mentioned in this episode by Jacob Robinson or his guests is not legal advice or investment advice. All opinions are Jacob's and his guests alone. Nothing discussed today should be relied upon for legal or investment decisions. This show is solely for information and entertainment purposes only. Jacob and his guests are not your lawyers, nor are they investment advisors. Please work directly with a lawyer or investment professional.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Law of Code podcast. I'm excited to share this episode with you covering the landscape of decentralized dispute resolution. My guest in this episode is Mark Cianci. Mark is counsel at Ropes and Gray, where he focuses his practice on digital asset litigation and compliance, as well as structuring and product development. His litigation experience gives him the ability to provide strategic advice to clients from a risk management perspective. He's also published a fantastic article on decentralized dispute resolution, which I will link in the show notes below. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you for having me, Jacob. Glad to be here.
And before we get into it, did you want to say your disclaimer now?
Oh, I'll just rattle those off. Views are my own, don't speak for my firm, and as everyone knows, not legal advice, not investment advice. That's all I got on disclaimers.
Perfect. Thanks, Mark. And so I'd love to hear your introduction to Bitcoin. Where were you when you first heard about it, and what did your initial thoughts look like?
Yeah, it's hard to pin down a precise date. I think what I'll focus in on is where it really crystallized for me. Because like many people, you always hear about it. I had heard about it early on in my career. When I was in law school, when I started law school, it was before the Satoshi white paper had even been published. So my entry into it was in the course of my career. And I was probably 2015, 2016 when I first started learning more about it. But I didn't get really deep until around 2020. And it was through conversations, some professional, but more just personal, family members, friends who were getting into Bitcoin as well as some altcoins more from an investment perspective. And I was looking to try to diversify my investment portfolio. And so I said, well, let me try and learn about this as a potential strategy and started buying up various coins, various assets. And I'm sure we'll get into it more, but it was through being forced to understand the market to make what I thought were wise or at least well-informed investment decisions that a light bulb quickly went off around 2021. And I said, there's actually a pretty good product market fit here between some of my legal practice that at that point I had been engaged in for over a decade and this emerging but rapidly growing digital asset space.
And I found around 2020, 2021 was a great example of my thinking or realizing that my thoughts around things like Bitcoin were shared by many others. And it wasn't just a few people out on a limb thinking that this technology has value and offers an enormous opportunity moving forward. And I can imagine you felt similarly then. This podcast will be structured primarily around the idea of dispute resolution. So I thought we could start with you giving a high-level overview of how dispute resolution has changed through the years before we talk about what it could look like in a Web3 world.
Definitely. There have been, well, it depends on how far back you want to go. And my right. practice is US-focused. My office is in Boston, Massachusetts, in the U.S., and so my vantage point is particularly American-focused. Have some done a little practice in Canada, associating with foreign lawyers, also in France and a few other spots. But taking a particularly U.S.-focused view, there has been quite an expansion of focus, emphasis, and momentum toward various forms of alternative dispute resolution. And that it, there's a commercial mechanism behind that where many sophisticated parties understood that some of the drag and drain associated with what can sometimes be an unwieldy standard litigation process in America, which can involve sometimes many years of discovery, which depending on which side of the V you're on, you may argue is fairly burdensome and overextensive. Against that backdrop of litigation drag, various counterparties, again, especially sophisticated commercial counterparties, have been trending, not exhaustively, not necessarily even at, on a majority level, but some significant portion toward alternative dispute resolution, which is really just a catch-all for anything beyond standard state or federal court litigation, and in particular, as relates to the broader decentralized dispute resolution topic, have been trending towards some form of arbitration, which is essentially just privatized courts.
And why have we seen that trend continue to be affirmed over the years? And it seems like that is continuously the case, where the litigation side is obviously still an important factor, but we are seeing many more individuals and businesses tend to prioritize these arbitration clauses, particularly through contracts.
I would attribute it to a few factors. One is customizability. Another is predictability. And those oftentimes go hand in hand. So take a standard commercial contract between two commercial counterparties of equal bargaining power. And then I'm going to pivot to another context in a second. But first, equal bargaining power. Both of those commercial counterparties may understand that there are, even though they're going to be going, if in the event of a dispute, are going to be completely adverse to each other, there are certain elements of the way that that dispute can be structured in advance that can be advantageous to both of them. For example, you can customize, and I do this on a day-to-day, not day-to-day, but on a periodic level in my practice, you can customize these arbitration clauses to say things like, how many arbitrators are you going to have? What is the scope of discovery going to look like? Is it going to be massive free-ranging discovery, which is typical of traditional U.S. litigation practice, where any document that has any propensity to advance one party's themes or defenses or claims is within scope? Or is it going to be something more curtailed and circumscribed? How many depositions are you going to take? What is the timeline going to be for this dispute resolution process? What sort of pre-arbitration hearing motions are going to be permitted and contemplated? And anything else, I won't belabor it, but anything else on the menu of how a litigation process may play out can be customized and prepackaged in advance. So that with that customization also comes, like I said earlier, a concept of certainty and predictability, because you're now no longer wondering how many if we go into a dispute, how many depositions are we going to have? How long it's going to take? Who's going to decide this? All of those otherwise variables can be pre-wired. And look, litigation is risky enough and has enough uncertainties already built in, where if you can pre-order some of that in advance in a way that both parties are signed off on, it can make for a more productive, you're still adverse, but the framework for that dispute in the event one arises is more productive and favorable towards what all parties agree in advance is a just and appropriate outcome.
Thank you, Mark. And I think that ties in nicely to the next point and the subject of this discussion, which is this idea of decentralized justice. And in the article that you published with your team at Ropes Gray, you touch on this idea of smart contracts and how you can essentially take all those benefits that you described there and encode them and automate them in a manner that removes the need for reliance on any third parties necessarily, and can put the rules in place in a manner that they can automatically be executed without necessary buy-in or conformity by certain parties. Could you describe this idea of decentralized justice and how it is a natural progression from dispute resolution throughout the years?
Absolutely. And there's a lot embedded in that question, so I'll take it in parts. First, I would like to focus on the ethos behind, well, let me actually just first define decentralized justice as I think about it. I think decentralized justice as it currently stands, can take broadly one of two forms. And then those two forms all have various substrains. But I think one form of decentralized justice is really focused on that smart contract dimension that you alluded to. So because we now have the availability of blockchain technology and the embedded automatic execution that smart contracts enable, parties can pre-wire in an otherwise traditional arbitration clause that has the same 1 to 3 arbitrators that we oftentimes see in a standard arbitration clause and has some of the more traditional other arbitration features of those clauses, the parties could pre-wire some automatic execution mechanism that would resolve one of the main lingering uncertainties that currently besets alternative dispute resolution, including arbitration, which is enforceability. So the way arbitration works now, parties will go through the whole arbitration process, and then if there's some really favorable judgment that one party loves and the other party hates, it's not the end of the road, even though parties waive all appeals and all other sorts of protective mechanisms in the arbitration clause, parties will still run into court, usually it's federal court, and say, if they were on the losing end of the arbitration, we challenge that, that's no good. And in the meantime, oftentimes the payment of that judgment is suspended or delayed. So there's this deferred enforceability and a deferred realizability of the outcome of the arbitration. Now enter what I'll call light form of decentralized dispute resolution. The parties could agree in advance to, once a dispute is triggered and that arbitration process kicks off, there's some automatic escrow, and that amount could be escrowed in advance. And once the arbitration process kicks off, that amount, which would be set forth in the arbitration provision, would be automatically held in escrow. And then once the outcome of the arbitration is realized, as a pure function of smart contracts, which the parties would have, again, all agreed to the conditions in advance, all agreed to the resulting outcomes in advance, that arbitration escrow amount would automatically move from the escrow wallet to the victor's wallet. There could even be side wallets for things like legal fees, and parties could automatically submit their invoices for legal fees on a smart contract basis. So if there's fee shifting embedded in the arbitration, that fee shifting functionality could be automatically executed. That sort of self-execution and integration of blockchain technology to minimize the risk of challenge or at least diminished collectability of arbitration judgments is what I think of as the light form of decentralized dispute resolution. It's taking some aspects of the promise and advantages of blockchain technology and embedding it into a more traditional arbitration framework.
And when we do talk about these benefits and how aspects of the arbitration process and dispute resolution process will be automated, will be encoded, that will come with many benefits. Could you describe what you see as being the main benefits with this approach over time, particularly in the short term? But I'd also be interested in hearing far out, if things like this are implemented at a wide scale, what those major benefits could be.
For sure. And I think that's a good segue into what I'll call the beefier form of dispute resolution. But let me answer the benefits question in the first instance for what I've characterized as the light form of decentralized dispute resolution. I think the principal benefits are what I alluded to previously, which is eliminating the uncertainty around collectability of enforcement judgments. When everything is automatically executable via smart contract and pre-escrowed wallets and self-authenticating and self-executing digital asset transfers, all of that uncertainty goes away. Now, it doesn't mean that a party couldn't then file in federal court and seek to reverse the automatic operation of those smart contract transfers. But in the meantime, the party who agreed in advance would receive the money in the event of a successful award. They're sitting on the assets. So in a world where possession is 9/10 of the law, that party is very well situated there. But to I think fully unpack and fully realize the benefits of decentralized dispute resolution, you really have to shift focus into what I'll call the built out or beefed up form of decentralized dispute resolution, which preserves everything I just talked about, has all that self-executing, all those self-executing features built right in, but it goes a step further and it really embraces at a macro level the theory behind blockchain, which is more decentralization is always better. Now, when you, if you really believe that and you run that concept through a litigation and arbitration context, what you emerge with is instead of one arbitrator or three arbitrators or even five arbitrators, you could envision a scenario where the decision makers for the dispute are now a diffuse group of anonymized or pseudonymized individuals who receive discrete pieces of evidence-focused information in a secure manner via their wallets, and then render on a blockchain a vote associated with resolution of that dispute, again, in a fully authenticated manner, but still pseudonymized, such that the decision makers are now no longer a small group of people. Maybe they're heavily specialized, maybe they're heavily qualified, but there's some uncertainty as to the outcome, because even if you have five really smart, really qualified people, if three of them go some way that you don't expect, you are now left with this very unanticipated outcome. Whereas if you spread the decision-making authority across a group of, say, 1,000 people, and you also build in some kind of a threshold mechanism where unless a party wins in a 60-40 split or a 55-45 split, there's a redo. You've now embedded an additional layer of confidence. If you believe in decentralization, you've embedded an additional layer of confidence in the outcome, and the blockchain mechanism resolves a lot of the otherwise logistical barriers that would be associated with having 1,000 people resolve a dispute because of the networking impact and the easily transferable nature of information across a blockchain. Now you've paved the way for something that is truly decentralized, where it's actually not impossible to envision having 1,000 people resolve a really important dispute. Happy to expand on that, but that's in a nutshell the idea.
Thank you, Mark. And I do want to expand on the one point you mentioned, which is the benefits that having this done on the blockchain itself can bring, because to play devil's advocate or to even just think about something like this, why can't you just institute something like Cedar's or Edgar's a bad example, but something where it's like almost an online-based jury process where it all goes through one platform, there's KYC conducted, and then people use that as a voting mechanism. Is there any particular reason why you see a blockchain and a smart contract-based solution being preferable in this case?
Yeah, and I don't mean to suggest that you couldn't build a system that approximates or at least has certain elements of these benefits without a blockchain, but as in many things in digital assets, there's a certain holistic or puristic bent towards doing things, quote unquote, the right way. So I think just if people are looking to promote adoption of some form of decentralized dispute resolution, you're going to spur greater adoption by doing it in a way that people within the digital asset and broader blockchain community perceive as consistent, perceive as true to the values and true to the principles, rather than doing something that is more of a in-between or from a purist perspective, quote-unquote, half-baked way. That's only a partial answer, though, because that's more about how it's going to be perceived rather than what the actual impact would be. I think at a practical level, having this decentralized dispute resolution process executed and implemented on a blockchain facilitates a couple important features. One is the pseudonymity that I alluded to earlier. If everyone, let's say, I'm going to make a really wild example, but let's say it was all done on Facebook. You could get onto Facebook, you could watch some video, and then you could like or dislike, and that would be your way of rendering a determination. There are a lot of potential privacy and influence, undue influence considerations that would, I think, render a decision-making format of that nature highly suspect. There wouldn't be a lot of confidence in it. And I certainly, in that, which I admit is an extreme example, wouldn't be advising my client to pre-wire agreement to be bound by a decision-making process like that. In addition to the anonymity and the protection from undue influence, there's also the security that a blockchain-based voting structure enables. In fact, this is beyond the scope of this discussion, but some people are talking about using blockchain as a way to resolve voter authentication and voter fraud concerns, even at a broader political level. So that's just a footnote. But the security that blockchain-based voting enables in this particular context for dispute resolution is an additional advantage, right? So no one, because everything is protected by the encoding and by the cryptography associated with the blockchain, you have a much, not saying there are never hacks, obviously, but if the coding works, if everything is functioning the way it should be, you're not going to have a problem where someone gets in and messes with the vote in some way that's hard to note, and then you have people lacking confidence in the outcome. So I think the protection against undue influence, the anonymity or pseudonymity associated with the voting, and the security of the voting are three distinct advantages that the blockchain delivers in this context.
I'm glad you mentioned those, because I think it is easy for people to point to this idea of a blockchain and point to a centralized ledger and think, well, the difference is that the blockchain is much more expensive. It's much slower. Typically, it requires buy-in from many more people. Whereas if you trust the existing court system, you can just go through that way. But there is that hidden cost and that almost opportunity cost of taking that approach rather than something where you can improve the efficiencies tremendously. But also the point you really underscored is the importance that it has to work on the back end. It does have to be a verifiable, immutable, transparent ledger, right? There can't be any way. You have to trust that settlement layer and that the execution itself. And I think the biggest opportunity that blockchain allows, in my opinion, is the ability to actually affect settlement. Whereas if in a traditional sense or even on a centralized system, you still need to go and convince the bank or any other party to make that transaction that may have been enforced or decided through this dispute mechanism.
Right. And that I completely agree with that. And I also want to add in one additional feature, which I wouldn't put in the same headline category as the three that we just covered. But there's an additional benefit of being able to do this on a blockchain, and that is automatic, seamless integration with escrowed digital asset wallets. And in particular, one challenge that some observers of this emerging trend around decentralized dispute resolution have identified is potential incentive problems amongst the voting pool. How do you ensure that if you're really going to entrust some massive commercial dispute to 1,000 diffuse individuals who you don't know who they are, you don't know whether they're qualified in a legal manner, in an industry manner, in an educational manner, in a career manner, or in any other way, how can you trust that those 1,000 individuals are going to make a right decision? And one answer to that is incentives. So if individuals are required to, for example, post their own crypto as collateral, much in the way that staking validation works in proof of stake blockchains, and then have that collateral either rewarded with some plus up if their votes are deemed to be appropriate or slashed if their votes are deemed to be inappropriate, you now have some form of guaranteed buy-in. You eliminate the risk that you're going to have people who actually aren't qualified to, I won't say eliminate, you mitigate the risk that you're going to have people who aren't qualified to be rendering decisions of dispute in disputes of this nature, but who nonetheless don't have anything better to do, log on and just are hitting buttons while they're playing online poker and not really focusing on the evidence being presented. Those people would very, very soon have all of their collateral slashed and wouldn't be profitable for them. So some of those incentive maximizing features that observers of decentralized dispute resolution prioritize are enabled and promoted by integration with some blockchain features such as posting your collateral through wallets.
I'm glad you mentioned some of those additional risks and the underlying incentive mechanisms that blockchains offer, where now you can look at the best predictor of human behavior and create a system that can ideally self-reinforce the objectives you're hoping to achieve. When you think about the risks from a legal perspective of decentralized dispute resolution, the one obvious one that comes to mind is you don't know who's voting necessarily. That could always change, but then it becomes anything going on behind the scenes, bribery, things like that. But what do you see as being some of the legal considerations as it comes to the risks of this technology being widely adopted?
For me, I think the biggest barrier to broad adoption is going to be at the stage where parties are decide. Let's say there are parties, they're already comfortable with some kind of smart contract feature integration into their arbitration clause, what I'd term the light form. That's easy to sell because some of the risks that we talked about, they aren't really present in that lighter form. I think what's going to, at least at an initial phase, keep contracting parties from going to the next step and pushing headlong into decentralized dispute resolution is reluctance on the part of lawyers who are drafting those provisions to face a complaint by their, not a legal complaint, maybe a legal complaint, but more likely just a verbalized complaint later on saying, hey, you recommended to me that I should do this dispute resolution and this decentralized dispute resolution, and now we're in it. And it turns out that whatever forum you all selected in that provision, they've only done 16 prior disputes. Whereas if you go with some traditional arbitration, maybe AAA or JAMS or an international arbitration forum, that forum collectively has overseen thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of disputes. And so there's this uncertainty and lack of a tried and true presence in some of these mechanisms that I think will inhibit lawyers from being confident recommending these structures to their clients. And so maybe I'm anticipating your next question, but I think the way to overcome that is, like anything, the true believers are going to be the ones who are going to be the test cases, so to speak. So I think decentralized dispute resolution, which I at a certain level, I have no incentive to be supportive of, because one of the outcomes of decentralized dispute resolution could be a shrinking of litigation process. And as a litigator, big, messy litigations, that's how I make my living 9 to 5. But on the other hand, I think embracing a system where some of the excess in litigation can be trimmed and streamlined at a global level is good for everybody, including litigators, because now instead of sending 16 letters to the other side explaining how they've missed 19 documents in their production and they got 6 things wrong in their privilege log, you're getting to the core of the issue more rapidly. So I think for people who are proponents of decentralized dispute resolution, it's going to be the blockchain hardcore adherents, the blockchain companies themselves, who are going to need to agree to use that format in advance. And then once the blockchain related investors, entrepreneurs, exchanges, everyone else in the blockchain community comes on board and people outside the blockchain community see that it's working for those people who already believe in blockchain, that will then pave the way for, say, a company where it's a company that builds homes contracting with the plumber that's going to do all the plumbing in that suite of homes. Nothing to do with blockchain, but that group of contracting participants has seen decentralized dispute resolution work for other industry participants in other contexts and says, why not try it out here? That's my forecast. Who knows whether I'm right, but that's my forecast for eventual adoption. And I think it's a years, not months proposition. There are a few platforms out there where you can sign up in advance and have your dispute run through a decentralized dispute resolution process, but it's still fairly nascent. And even since I published my article about a year ago, there have been several other articles that have come out, and they're still remarking on how fairly new all of this is.
I agree, and I think the manner of growth will likely be in the way you described, where this makes a ton of sense for individuals and groups in the blockchain ecosystem already to begin to adopt and to test out and to iterate on that. And the physical world, you could say the laws that we have established in different countries across the world, they've evolved over time, and typically they're adjusted to fit the edge cases within the rules and to tailor the rules to fit any particular instance that could come up. Now we have all these pre-processes and post-processes that have been created for reasons. But it's interesting where you have something like ADR that sits outside the litigation or sits separately from litigation that can offer a much more streamlined process. And it almost seems like there are these varying levels of diligence and various levels of detail in which individuals and parties want to go in. And then this gives them an even quicker option in that respect.
Yeah. And I think in addition to that, I had dropped a footnote to this earlier, but we've talked a lot about commercial contracts. It's one sophisticated party contracting with another sophisticated counterparty. You can also envision ADR being adopted on the fairly early stage. Maybe the phasing here is blockchain ecosystem folks are the first early adopters. And then maybe before you have the two counterparties outside the blockchain ecosystem coming on board, there might be this intermediate phase where you have the commercial entity on one hand, and then some of these terms of use or other mass-produced consumer-facing contracts that we all sign in to, we all use every time we sign into an online platform, or we all adhere to, at least in theory, every time we get a receipt from a retailer and there's terms of use on the back. Those terms of use oftentimes embed an ADR mechanism, but there's oftentimes and a mandatory ADR mechanism where parties are purporting to waive their rights to litigate as a class and all sorts of other things. And those terms of use are oftentimes challenged as allegedly unfair, and there's a whole body of law around that. I think one way that these consumer-facing contracts, oftentimes called terms of use, could achieve less resistance when the rubber meets the road and they're sought to be enforced is to build in some form of DDR element. And you could even say, check this out, you could even say the pool of 1,000 voters, or let's say you want to scale it back and say 200 voters, 150 of those will be other folks who have signed up through the same terms of use. And so you're building in this embedded automatic buy-in where, at least at a communal level, at least at a categorical level, you're not subjecting yourself to a resolution of the matter by someone outside your own world. You're saying, yeah, other consumers who agreed to use this product or use this service, they're the ones who are going to be deciding this dispute. And it's actually a real show of confidence by the retailer or the sophisticated party in those transactions to say, yeah, I'm this confident in the appropriateness of my products, the appropriateness of my services, that I'm going to let other consumers of my service resolve any disputes that one or more consumers may raise. And I think when you're putting yourself out there with that level of confidence, it embeds a level of engagement and buy-in that I think is valuable and would tend towards less resistance and fewer challenges to the applicability and enforceability of some of these consumer-focused terms of use than you currently see out there in the litigation sphere.
Thank you, Mark. And in terms of where you see the digital asset space going, I want to step away from decentralized dispute resolution for a second and just touch on the broader sphere. Are there projects that you have seen develop, ideally outside of the financial sphere as well? I've just found the first iteration of builders in this space have been financial focused, but this is a great example of how there is so many interesting things happening. Like Claros is a good example of what was ideally to be some form of decentralized dispute resolution. But are there other projects or areas of blockchain that you find particularly interesting or are seen developed in a way that you think will have a profound impact?
Absolutely. And I think the fact, if you ask people 2 or 3 years ago, what is the difference between blockchain and crypto? Most people, even a lot of people in the industry, might not be able to provide a readily articulable answer. I think now, and I think some of the negative developments that we're all aware of over the past year plus have helped advance this narrative that blockchain is not crypto. Crypto is not blockchain. And it's almost a historical accident that the first primary use case of blockchain is through fungible cryptocurrency. Now, it's an awesome use case. I love it. I'm super supportive of the Bitcoin blockchain and many other digital asset transfer focused blockchains. But I think what the past 2 or 3 years, and especially over the last year, have demonstrated is blockchain is so much more than that. And that observation was what helped animate my motivation to put this article out, the article that we've been talking around. But I think there are lots of other really impactful applications. So one of them that I'm sure you and your listeners are fairly familiar with is the supply chain world and being able to embed a fully trackable layer of certainty around products, services, information, where it's come from, where it's going, who's been involved with it. That is becoming all the more necessary as we see increased scrutiny regarding things like human slavery, human trafficking, extortion, and all manner of societal ills that we as Americans and Canadians and really across the world, we don't want to be any part of. Those supply chain related integration features that blockchain technology promises can be very influential. Now, oddly enough, it hasn't really blossomed in the way that a lot of people predicted, but I think those are more just bumps in the road as opposed to fundamental problems with the concept. And so I think supply chain is a huge area. The other area is somewhat adjacent to the financialization of blockchain applications, but it takes it in a completely different direction, which is tokenization of everything. Mm-hmm. And if you step back and think about what assets are out there in the world, right? You got real estate, you got debt, you got equity. And right now, if you look at the total market cap of digital assets and you compare it to the total market cap of other assets, it's a literal drop in the bucket. People worry about, oh, is the crypto market 1 trillion, 2 trillion, 3 trillion? But you're literally talking about hundreds upon hundreds of trillions of dollars of assets out there in the world. And virtually all of them, this is the punchline, virtually all of them are susceptible to some form of tokenization. And it's not just you're converting, let's say, a piece of real estate that's worth $1 million into a piece of split up tokenized digital asset interest in that real estate that are also worth $1 million. What our experience has shown, and I talk to industry participants in tokenization on a weekly basis, that tokenization is itself a driver of value. So when you take something that's worth $1 million untokenized and you tokenize it, it's now all of a sudden, just by pure greater access, greater liquidity, less friction, it's now worth maybe 1.2 or 1.3 or even 1.5 million. And so as participants realize the advantages of tokenizing all of these assets, I'm not saying Bitcoin's going to be a distant memory or just a side note, but on a pure market cap level, it's the tokenization of real world assets and intangible assets that I think is going to be the ultimate onset on a macro global level of the real promise that blockchain technology offers.
I agree. I think it's such an exciting time to be working in the legal field relating to this, because we have an idea and a vision of what the future can look like, but it is so murky when it comes to regulation and how that will actually take form, that there will be undoubtedly very interesting times over the next few months, years, and decades. Last question for you, Mark, is just regarding advice. Is there any advice you were given early in your career that has shaped who you have become today?
Absolutely. And so you're saying, irrespective of the blockchain dimension of my career, just more broadly?
Yes.
Oh, man. I am nothing if not the sum of the inputs of my mentors. Literally, all I've done in practice is look at someone, usually within my firm, sometimes my adversary, sometimes at a third party, and observe them and see what I would want to emulate in them. And I know people fall at various ends of that spectrum. Some people come into a profession with a really clear sense of, here's my professional identity, here's who I am based on my upbringing, my societal factors when I was younger. For me, I was really thrown into this professional world in a way that was unfamiliar to me in a vacuum. And so I looked around and said, wow, look at her. She has such amazing poise in front of that judge. Or look at him. When he writes a brief, the first line sucks you in like some novel that you want to read until 4 a.m. Because it's so interesting. And so a lot of it was by immersion and infusion. And then along the way, I think a good mentor teaches by example, not by didaction, not by just saying, do it this way. But I think a good mentor also augments the teaching by example with punctuated inflection points of saying, did you think that worked? And actually being open to feedback. I mean, I've been in war rooms with attorneys who have been in practice 30 years when I was in the practice for 5 years, and who asked for my feedback, and not in some sort of perfunctory check the box way, but who actually wanted it and who actually implemented the feedback that I, as a relatively junior lawyer, provided. And I think that humility that they exhibited and the openness to learn and to be flexible based on input from others instead of going in guns blazing, just assuming that your way or the highway is the only way to go. That all was heavily influential on me, but it was all kind of in an undercurrent. It was no one sitting me down and saying, here's how to be a good lawyer. It was, come alongside me. We're in the trenches together. We're trying to achieve amazing outcomes for clients. And just by absorption and being immersed in that environment, you learn so much. So it wasn't one particular thing or even one particular conversation, but to the extent that some of your listeners are more on the junior side and maybe they're trying to scope out a career or trying to align with a firm or group to get started with, I think having a keen awareness of what sort of mentorship, formally and informally, you'll achieve at that, especially those early stages of your career, that should literally be the top of your list. Maybe geography if you've got family considerations, but beyond, more than compensation, more than practice area, more than exposure, publicity, it's who you're going to learn from, because that'll really shape you as you emerge as a professional.
Think on who you learn from. And thankfully, I've had the privilege of learning from people like yourself and the other guests of the podcast. And I'm sure everyone listening echoes that thought. Thank you, Mark, for joining me today. Really enjoyed this conversation.
Thank you so much, Jacob. Appreciate it. Bye.